Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Ku Klux Klan from 1915 to 24. This is the period that's generally thought of as being the kind of the second era of the Ku Klux Klan. The first is during the Restoration period in the 1860s and 1870s after the end of the Civil War. And the second period of the Ku Klux Klan is really motivated by quite different racial tensions in America. If we turn our attention to the first period of the Ku Klux Klan after the end of the Civil War is relatively easy to explain. The imposition of the Union Army on the South, the liberation of the slaves and the emancipation of the slaves, and the emergence in the South of a society under Reconstruction, where the rights, voting rights of blacks were upheld by a presidential decree, particularly President Grant. This leads to an embattled, fearful, and threatened Southern white, in certain parts of the South, minority who look upon the emergence of a free black population as a catastrophe. The emergence of the Ku Klux Klan as a terror organisation is partly the result of the kind of the withdrawal of the Northern armies gradually. Northern administration and the kind of the collapse really of the Reconstruction project in the South and the re-establishment of white rule. By the time you get to the late 1870s and the introduction of Jim Crow laws, there's less of a need for violent terror actions to oppress the Southern blacks, because you have the state legislatures able to do this. So by the 1880s and 1890s, whilst there is still segregation, well, there is still intense oppression of black Americans in the Deep South, it doesn't need to be done in a paramilitary style, because you have federal state governments have the power to do it once again, and it's the South is becomes once again the place where the federal government ideally doesn't want to go meddling and stirring up various hornets' nests. From 1915 to 1924 is a slightly different story, because it features not just the South, but the emergence of the Ku Klux Klan as a national force. And what possibly can explain this? Well, it is a product really of two things. It's a product of the First World War and a product of the economic crises that follow it. During the First World War, there is a decline in the flow of Southern and Eastern European white, impoverished, emigre peasant populations into the United States via New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and the eastern seaports. So the amount of available cheap factory labour decreases. This is partly due to the impassibility of the Atlantic during wartime, the wartime era, and to an increased isolationism from the American government and a fear of the kind of trouble that Europeans might bring to American shores. There's always a kind of a great concern about the dangers of revolution and who might be coming in from Eastern Europe with all sorts of frightening new ideas. The FBI believed it was their role, particularly in this period, to keep an eye on such troublemakers. So as the level of orders during the war in factories in the north dramatically begins to increase, the obvious choice for your cheap labour force are Southern blacks, who would be quite keen to escape a life of rural penury and racial discrimination in the South. When men become enlisted in the US Army, when large numbers of particularly white men, not to say that black soldiers didn't fight in France during the First World War, I've talked at length about the book Black Bolshevik by Harry Haywood, which has his accounts as a doughboy in France. But when white soldiers go to fight, leaving open factory jobs, there is this influx of black labour into previously white jobs in the north. And there is, I think I've talked about the Red Summer of 1919, there was a huge upsurge in violence against black Americans, from particularly from returning soldiers who find this rather frightening racial reordering of the labour market has occurred while they've been away. But I think something else is going on as well. If you could just simply put it down to that, then the fact that the Ku Klux Klan had begun to dramatically develop from 1915 onwards wouldn't make much sense, because you had to wait 2 full years for America to become fully engaged in the war. There seems to be some reason for this kind of upsurge in racial tensions across America for about 1915 onwards, and they come largely from rural communities. And so there is possibly something at play with the anxieties of farming folk during the war and during the war years. And I suspect it's got something to do with farm prices. Despite a huge increase in agricultural output and agricultural exports during the war, farm prices for much of the war era and profits by farms still lag behind this massive surge in output. And after the end of the war, you get America and really the rest of the world hit by a deflationary crisis. The war has seen this explosion in inflation, and after the war there is a slump in farm prices. So much of the appeal of the Ku Klux Klan perhaps comes from the economic insecurities of rural communities, white rural communities in America, and the fear at the same time that they are being subject to competition from other ethnic minorities. I know it's a kind of a kind of quite a radical left critique of American history that that class relations and economic relations are always complicated by race and ethnicity. But I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this is actually quite valid. This is the Howard Zinn view of things. Does seem to be, in this instance, quite valid, and the threatened ethnic minorities, or ethnic majorities in point of fact, who look upon the challenge to their position from groups like African Americans, react with extreme violence. And this perhaps explains why the Ku Klux Klan become a national movement far beyond the confines of the South at the end of the First World War. During the Red Summer of 1919, the FBI is far less interested in arresting racist murderers and people engaged in lynchings than they are in the hunt for subversives. During the 1919 and 1920, you have a Red Scare in America, where the Attorney General Mitchell Palmer believes that the country is under threat from subversion, and J. Edgar Hoover and the various rising stars of the FBI, who are of that persuasion, tend to concur. And so the focus at the time was never on the organised violence of the Ku Klux Klan. Yeah, even though in terms of the threat to the well-being of many American citizens was far more obvious and pronounced than anything that could be suggested about foreign subversion. The Ku Klux Klan by the 1920s is a far more broad-based bundle of prejudices. It's not simply just the suppression of blacks in the South that occupies their thinking. They view themselves as a Protestant, anti-Catholic, anti-Masonic, anti-immigrant, and anti-black organisation, and they view things in the terms that every kind of significant group of white racists tends to, probably not just limited to white racists either, but they view themselves as really kind of interpret themselves as an oppressed minority, as the really embattled culture that is facing annihilation, which obviously this is total nonsense. But even though things are kind of unjustifiable and unsustainable, it doesn't stop people from believing them. And the fact is, the interesting fact as historians is the fact that people did have this sense of anxiety about their status and position at the end of the First World War. And it shows us the extent to which the First World War had really thrown countless certainties, even in America, which had been almost completely unaffected by the war. The economics of war, the global economics of war, had thrown all these certainties for Americans to the wind, and a multi-ethnic society was facing crisis as a result. The second Klan seems to be far better organised than the first. It has a membership of 4 million. By 1924, so having reached its absolute height, it has a complex network of nationwide organisations and branches. But as with all organisations that explode out of nowhere,
millions of people have lost weight with personalised plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Waves of popular discontent. It's riven with internecine factions and infighting, and never becomes the serious threat to American liberal democracy that it might otherwise have been. But that's not to underestimate its influence in the early 1920s. It initiates its members in mass torchlight rallies, with thousands and thousands of new recruits being brought into the movement in huge initiation rituals. In certain parts of America, and particularly in the South, there is a virtual ethnic cleansing of black Americans who are forced to flee neighbourhoods or who are killed. And certain cities which had large black populations become whitened by the mid-1920s. Florida is a particular example where there are several cities that have this process of ethnic cleansing. And it's fascinating, isn't it, to think that in the 1920s, when, you know, ethnic cleansing and mass movements of populations are happening in Europe, and between what is left of the Ottoman Empire, say, for example, and Greece, or movements of people following the divisions of the new map-making exercises that happened at the Treaty of Versailles. Similar things, perhaps on not quite the same scale, are actually happening in America. These sort of upheavals are forcing black populations to flee from this resurgent white nationalist kind of proto-fascist movement. And the implications for American democracy are also affected by the fact that in 1923 in Texas, Alabama and Indiana, senators are returned with large majorities, all of whom are Klan members. And in southern Illinois, there's a virtual civil war between rival factions of the Ku Klux Klan. And in other states, the influence of the Ku Klux Klan on the judiciary, the police, local and federal government structures is overwhelming. So there are almost, particularly Oregon, for example, is almost a Klan-run state by the early 1920s. The economic processes of inflation and deflation that happened during the First World War and its aftermath affect American farmers to the extent that they never really recover. American farm prices never really recover. They are aided by subsidies for the rest of the 20th century. And part of the reason for this is that the war has encouraged massive overproduction of farm produce because Europe is unable to feed itself. Large sections of large arable lands such as northern France and Belgium are wiped out by German occupation. And also various European populations have to undergo the privations of war, have to allocate their foodstuffs to their armed forces, and their young men and horses are sent off to fight. So it's a great opportunity for American farmers to overproduce. But again, this overproduction cripples American farm prices, leading to a forerunner of the Great Depression. The Great Depression from in the 1930s for American farmers really seems to be kind of almost undistinguishable from the rest of their experience in the 1920s. There is, for them, very little let-up, and the kind of the jazz age of the 20s, where people appear to be having all sorts of fun, I don't think ever really materialises in a great deal of farms in the Midwest. The result of all this is that the government, always mindful of the fear of mass populist movements, demagogues arising, and dangerous radical ideas, have all sorts of efforts under Roosevelt's New Deal from 1933 onwards to underwrite farm prices, particularly with the Agricultural Adjustment Agency. And part of this really is the preservation of American democracy. Roosevelt knew full well that unless something was done, unless there was some kind of initiative to stabilise the American economy, then an economic crisis would transform itself into a political crisis. Now, it goes without saying that a key figure in galvanising support for the Ku Klux Klan, while he professed this was unintentional, I suspect otherwise, was the filmmaker D.W. Griffith. In 1915, D.W. Griffith created really the first feature film. It was technically ahead of its time, but it depicted the Ku Klux Klan. This was Birth of a Nation, I beg your pardon. Depicted the Ku Klux Klan as heroic rescuers of American values. When D.W. Griffith created it, it was extremely popular despite its overtly racist message. It was in the same year that the Klan reforms in Atlanta and Georgia, and obviously focusing on this far wider set of goals. In 1917, the Manifesto of the Klan summed it up as being summed up the purpose, the mission statement of the Klan as being to shield the sanctity of the home and the chastity of womanhood, to maintain white supremacy, to teach and faithfully inculcate a high spiritual philosophy through an exalted ritualism, and by practical devotedness to conserve, protect and maintain the distinctive institutions, rights, privileges, principles and ideals of pure Americanism. So it was about protecting the notion of white culture, this particularly notion of the protecting the chastity of womanhood conjures up all sorts of repressed notions of the fear of being of a kind of racial mixing and miscegenation, and the fear that white women may have relationships with black men, and that there may be kind of a threat to the continuation of the white race. Of course, this is in the era or the heyday of eugenics, where even in the United Kingdom, supposedly in intellectual circles such as the Bloomsbury Group, the likes of T.S. Eliot and Virginia Woolf have more than a flirtation with eugenics, the kinds of sort of Marie Stopes eugenics of having the working classes spayed, in essence, to prevent them from outbreeding the middle classes who've been annihilated during the First World War. The Ku Klux Klan were very keen on prohibition, and partly for that is that there's a racial element to prohibition. They believe that prohibition should be rigorously enforced, partly because Irish, Polish, Italian and Jewish gangsters seem to dominate the alcohol trade. There's some very interesting, if you watch the excellent HBO series Boardwalk Empire, there are some very interesting tensions between various prohibition, alcohol racketeering gangs and the Ku Klux Klan. This is in Atlantic City during the 1920s. The extent to which that is absolutely verifiably true, I'm not sure. But there is, I believe, a book to go with the series written all about Atlantic City during the time. So the new wizard of the Ku Klux Klan was William J. Simmons, who declared himself the Imperial Wizard and found lots of new followers, not just in the South, but also in the North. There was a renewed focus after 1919 that non-Anglo-Saxon Europeans, Poles, Greeks, Italians, Yugoslavs and Jews might provide American factories once again with the kind of cheap labour that they'd been providing in the 1910s. And the United States House Committee on Rules calls Simmons to testify in 1921. And this shows that despite the growing influence of the Klan and its growing political influence and its mass membership, the US government itself wasn't completely blind to the threats it presented. The high point of the Klan's notoriety was when Hiram Wesley Evans, the imperial wizard who takes over after Simmons, becomes the Time magazine pinup of the year in 1924. Bear in mind, obviously, in 1933, their man of the year is Adolf Hitler. In 1926, the Klan is able to parade 30,000 men through Washington, D.C. But this trial of show of strength is kind of illusory. It happens right at the very point when membership is starting to dwindle as the mid-20s economy starts to pick up and things start to become less difficult for a great many Americans. Membership, the importance of membership becomes declines, and also the organisation is rocked with scandal. There is a high profile murder trial of one of the Klan's senior members, and this is the murder of a white woman, and it's a sexual crime. So the murder, obviously, or lynching of blacks in the South, which was happening at the rate of about 100 a year, that's obviously not an issue. But when a white woman is killed by a Klansman, it becomes a major controversy. And the problem that the Klan has as well is that it's this federation of small chapters, each with its own set of localised bigotries and internecine feuds and agendas and objectives. So there is a kind of a fragmentation, which leads by the end of the 1920s to the movement having declined from 4 million to a few tens of thousands. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and pleased to announce that we're just coming to the end of proofreading and editing of Tyrell Eskelson's brilliant new addition to the Explaining History series, The American Century. So if you enjoyed Chris Kostov's The Communist Century, if you enjoyed Julia Routledge's The Genocidal Century, Tyrell's new book is going to be out hopefully between now and Christmas, and that should be a brilliant addition to the Century series. So I hope you can check that out soon. Thanks very much, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.